to the Michael Rivero What Really Happened radio program.
And aloha, America. Welcome to the show here. And it is Wednesday. It is hump day and middle of the week, starting that long slide down to the Pauhana Friday. And we're looking at a lot of stuff in the news. Before we really get into the show, though, just a reminder that our phone number is 800-259-9231. 800-259-9231. And Donovan is answering the phones and twiddling the dials today. So when you call in, that is who will answer the phone. Now, the Dow dropped another 80 today. It was all over the place today. I mean, it was a rowdy ride. I imagine this is one of the days when people are definitely taking their Valiums on the trading floor, because it's way up and then it's way down, then it's way up, then it's way down, and then it really went up and then it started back down again and was definitely on a downtrend at the closing bell. So we'll see what happens tomorrow. I stand by my prognostication that we will see the Dow into the 6,000s by the middle of March. So we shall see what that is going to do. Now, obviously, big news is that last night, Barack Obama's televised speech to a joint session of Congress, effectively State of the Union kind of stuff. But he talked mostly about the economy. And I think the reaction to the speech was kind of lukewarm, certainly to judge by the stock market today. Secondarily, it seems that it's mostly platitudes. He's saying the things that he knows people want to hear him say without actually saying how it's going to be accomplished. And I think, like so many of our recent presidents, Barack Obama hasn't quite emotionally accepted that he's won the election, because he's still out there campaigning. He's still out there trying to sell you on what he's going to be doing. And my message to the White House, and I know some of them are listening to this show right now, is, okay, you got the job. Now you got to do the job. And what we need is not campaigning and not more speeching. We need leadership. We need somebody to sit down and actually figure out how to get things going. Now, he did say one thing in the speech that obviously caught a lot of people's attention. He talked about ending the tax credits to corporations that are offshoring our jobs. And it certainly sounds good, and it's what we want to hear. And if he actually does it, it'll be one of the first things he's done that I actually agree with. However, it's not going to accomplish that much even if he does it, because the damage is already done. The tax credits were passed during the Bush administration to offset the cost of offshoring these jobs. In this very sick, twisted worldview, we, the American people, through our taxes, subsidized the costs of moving our jobs to other countries. Little irony there for those who have a taste for such things. So Barack Obama is going to end the tax credits. He's going to slam the door on the barn after the horse is gone. And the part that he's not addressing is, how do we get the horse back? Because the jobs are already in the foreign countries. Just ending the tax credits to move the jobs over there doesn't solve the problem, because the jobs are still there. It's only a halfway measure. What we need are tax incentives and tax cuts to make it financially attractive for corporations to bring those jobs back to the United States. And that is the part that Barack Obama did not mention last night. He said, we're going to stop giving the corporations money to take the jobs away. Well, the damage is done. I'm not sure anybody is even using those tax credits anymore, because the jobs are gone. What we need is a tax climate where taxes are low enough to make it cost effective to bring the jobs back here. Everyone talks about all these other countries where they pay their workers so little wages, and they're only paid a few dollars a day and so forth and so on. And what they don't really communicate is that the reason this is possible is it costs so much less to live in these places. These parts of the world. And the reason it costs so much less to live in these parts of the world is their taxes are lower. Their taxes are lower. And if we're going to be competitive with the rest of the world, we have got to stop taxing our working and middle class people into poverty. Because contrary to the propaganda you've heard over the years, you cannot tax the society into prosperity. All taxes do is put an increasing load on the economy until the economy stutters and stalls, which is what's happening right here. And I'm finally starting to see some other people are writing articles that are saying basically the same thing I've been saying on the show for a while. We need manufacturing to come back to this country to save the economy. And it is time to seriously scale back the military so that we don't have to pay the taxes that support that. Because that is the one difference between our economy, which is struggling to survive, and all these other industrialized economies that up until we stumbled and fell, they were doing pretty good. Because they're taking the money from their taxes and they're putting it back into their society. Whereas in the United States, we're taking half of all the taxes that we pay and we're putting it into stuff that kills people. No other nation on earth spends anywhere near as much on the weapons of war as the United States does. And if we turn that all off, if we just say, okay, third millennium, 21st century, you know, killing millions of brown people around the world is no longer fashionable and trendy. We turn that all off. We could cut federal taxes in half without surrendering any social programs at all whatsoever. And federal taxes would still be in half. Our cost of products would go down. Our cost of living would go down. We could actually take jobs for lower wages. And we could become competitive with the rest of the world. And we need to really start addressing that. And it's, we're not hearing it from Barack Obama, unfortunately, but we need to look at that. Now, getting on to Swindler's List, and I'm talking about Alan Stanford this time, we're beginning to see more and more that these sharpsters have been allowed to operate for years and years and years, even when there were formal complaints to the so-called regulatory agencies. And everyone talks about, oh, we need more regulation, we need this, we need that. They're talking about more regulation. The regulators we have weren't doing their job. The regulations weren't being followed. The inspectors weren't doing anything. Now we're finding out that two employees of Alan Stanford's financial business, which is now accused of this huge multi-billion dollar fraud, they held advisory roles in FINRA, which was a watchdog group overseeing brokers that was supposed to prevent abuses. Talk about the fox guarding the hen house. So let me run that by you one more time because there's a conclusion to the story. Two of Alan Stanford's employees held positions in the agency that was supposed to be watching out for these kind of abuses. And now, Barack Obama has picked the head of that same regulatory agency, FINRA, to be the head of the SEC, which is the agency which turned a blind eye to Bernie Madoff for 12 years. It's this little incestuous economic, you know, cancer in our society where they're just ripping people off, and the regulatory agencies, it's all the same people, and they go back and forth between these revolving doors. No wonder these multi-billion dollar pyramid schemes are gotten away with year after year after year. It's the same people. They're hiring the same people who are part of this crime are being made part of the police force. And it's just absolutely absurd that Obama would pick Mary Shapiro to head the SEC when the SEC is under so much criticism for turning a blind eye to Bernie Madoff, and FINRA itself is now compromised because they were supposed to be watching Alan Stanford, and instead they had two of his employees on their advisory board. It's just utter nonsense here. Now, let's see. We've got just a minute here. I'm going to take a moment to talk about a quick story. When we come back, we've got a listener question that they want answered on the air here. It turns out that I'm going to hold that story because that's a little bit more intense here. We had the Academy Awards here just the other night, and you know, everyone's talking about show business and everything. Apparently, Hollywood is preparing to make some 30 movies with a strong anti-Iranian theme. We were all talking about last Christmas on all the Holocaust movies and Holocaust this and Holocaust that, and endless pounding through our head about the Nazis were bad people, which nobody argues with, by the way. Now Hollywood has a slate of 30 movies with an anti-Iranian theme ready to go into production. Gee, is Hollywood being used for propaganda? I don't know. We'll be back after these words from our sponsors.
This is Cascadia Public Radio.
Welcome to the Michael Rivero What Really Happened radio program. Call Mike now at 800-259-9231. 800-259-9231.
And aloha, welcome back to the show here. And before we get back into the news and everything, I want to give a special shout out here to Radio Free Oklahoma at 107.1 FM, Oklahoma City, that has joined the ever-expanding family of What Really Happened affiliates. So hope you're enjoying the show out there in Oklahoma, and hope the weather is treating you a little better than it is here, us in Hawaii. Now, we had a listener email in a question. Here's the question. Hi, Mike. My question is this. Let's say most of the states decide to pull out of the Fed or the United States and just become individual states. Can they set up their own currency? What happens to the property owned by individuals? Bank account, auto, IRA account. This is a very, very complex issue. We went through that actually here in Hawaii when it was annexed by the United States. And they simply came in and said, well, these people don't own this land anymore. The new Republic of Hawaii does. And by golly, they're going to give us a big chunk of it for a naval base and that sort of thing. In the event of secession, I would assume, and again, this could change from state to state based on who is actually in control of the process. But I would assume that private property would remain, you know, in the same ownership. The state property would remain under state ownership. What would change would be property that was owned by the federal government would probably be annexed to the state. For the purposes of maintaining as much continuity as possible, I would assume all the bank accounts would be more or less kept the same. There would have to be a new currency, and the existing monetary system from the United States would have to be transitioned into it through some form of conversion. Now, I am going to speculate here, and I've certainly suggested it to our local government, but if the federal government were to collapse, I'm not talking about secession, I'm not talking about civil war, but I'm talking about the federal government collapse in the way that the USSR did. Prudence demands that state governments are already setting up planning committees to basically get ready for that contingency. Because if you wait until it actually happens and then try and figure out what you're going to do, you're going to be in trouble. So I would say probably all the states are at least starting to look at this idea that it might actually happen. Because if the national economy collapses, they're going to have to set up local economies just to operate within themselves. A lot of communities already are. There are a lot of communities that are starting to have their own local currencies to try and stimulate local trade and buying within the local community. And these have been around for quite some time. We have them out here in Hawaii. We have the Maui trade dollar and the Oahu trade dollar. When I lived in California, there were the Catalina trade dollars. And they're kind of a promotion situation, but they are used as a medium of exchange. There are alternative currencies out there already. One of the most famous was the Liberty dollar. And I'm still of the opinion that the only reason that one was targeted and shut down was because of the Ron Paul dollar. And a certain individual who was in the White House at that time, their ego got bruised. And so the Treasury Department and the government came in and shut down the Liberty dollar. But there are alternative currencies out there that are based on a unit of worth rather than a unit of debt. Obviously, the Federal Reserve is going to keep on putting as much pressure as possible to force us to continue to use their monetary system, which puts us permanently in debt to them. But more and more people are starting to talk about getting by without the Federal Reserve and coming up with an alternative monetary system. And as the federal government begins to weaken and lose power, I think we're going to see more and more of this happening. This brings me to the issue of state sovereignty. We are rapidly seeing more and more states introduce legislation and pass legislation basically saying that the states are reasserting their sovereignty under the Constitution of the United States, meaning that the federal government is forbidden from coming into the states and trying to run things there from D.C. when it is really none of their business under the Constitution. at some point there's going to be a showdown over this whole issue, and I think it is going to come along with this national service program. Because this national service program, and I don't care what name you call it by, it is conscription. It is a draft. They're going to grab you, put you in a standard gray federal uniform, give you a shovel, and send you out to do the work that you thought your taxes were paying for. But here's the problem. It's called the 13th Amendment of the United States, otherwise known as the Involuntary Servitude Amendment. And basically what it says is that it is illegal for the government to order you to do any kind of work or service unless you have been convicted of a crime and sentenced to that labor as part of your punishment. Now, this amendment is routinely skirted with regard to the military draft. They have this little ritual where they say, you know, those of you ready to serve your country, step forward. And when you step forward, they call it volunteering. Even though you got a draft notice and they will come and arrest you and throw you in jail if you don't show up, they call it volunteering to get around that. But more and more Americans need to be aware of this 13th Amendment. The government does not have the legal right to come in and pick you up and say, you're going to go out and pick up trash on the highway because we can't afford to actually hire somebody to do it. So where we're going to see a conflict between the federal government and the state sovereignty movement is probably going to be on this national service issue. And at some point, we may see the U.S. government send military force into a state to say, you will do what we tell you to do. And at that point, we're looking at a potential for civil war, especially if the economy continues to deteriorate and there are a lot of very hungry people who are very angry with the federal government, who will stand up with their state legislators and their governors and say, okay, enough is enough. It is time to call this experiment ended. So I think that's where that's going to happen. Now, if you live in San Francisco, you need to be very aware of some tax collection notices that went out to businesses in that city. It turns out they are, to put it politely, erroneous. They are actually from the city of San Francisco's Tax Collection Bureau. They are official, real tax collection notices. But somehow, they're sent out collecting taxes that aren't actually owed. The city of San Francisco is saying, we're sorry, you know, and if you call and tell us about it, we'll change the records. But the problem is that a lot of people are apparently paying this tax bill without thinking about it. And so all of a sudden, the city of San Francisco is getting this little windfall of cash coming in and starts to wonder, you know, what other tax notices are you getting aren't actually legal or aren't really based on a real assessment? As states and cities get more desperate for money, you know, might they try a little fast, little fun one and say, oh, well, you've got to pay us this fee and just rely on people sending in the money without looking at it? Anyway, all right, we're almost at the end of this segment here, and we've got a caller on the line, but Drew, I'm going to wait until we come back from this commercial break here. Meanwhile, just a real quick notice, boy, economic hard times, the scam artists are out in force, whether it's email. We got a really nice four-color printed ad in the mail, the regular postal mail the other day, about this, you know, envelope stuffing and earn money on your computer at home. Folks, you got to be really, really careful because somebody has declared open season on the ordinary working class American and nobody is looking out for you but you. Actually, I'm looking out for you, but you know what I mean. You got to be skeptical. We'll be back after these words from our sponsors.
This is the GCN Radio Network, home to hard-hitting talk radio.
What this country is coming to, I sure would like to know. If they don't do something by and by, the rich will live and the poor will die. Doggone, I mean the panic is on.
Back to the show here. A little bit of a musical interlude from back in the 1930s. The Great Depression, although the way things are going, we might start calling it the not-quite-so-Great Depression because of the way things are headed here. I mean, the real monster in the closet or under the bed or wherever monsters hide out is the derivatives exposure. The people who won those gambling debts, they're not going to just want to write them off. And it's a vast amount of money. And it never really existed. It's not like somebody really borrowed this money from the people and just refused to pay it back. This was the derivatives game, the little gambling, the going long, the going short, the credit default swaps, and all this stuff that turned Wall Street into a casino. And they ran up this huge, huge debt obligation. But it's all imaginary. We're going to go to the phones. We've got Drew in California. Aloha, Drew. Welcome to the show. What's on your mind today?
Well, I wanted to talk about ideas for reconstruction, but first I just wanted to make a comment. I've been hearing the last few weeks, hearing you keep saying that it seems like maybe Alex Jones is right, and I think you're both right. I think it's a little too complicated to say one or the other. Certainly the people at the top, the people making the decisions, they know exactly what they're doing. They understand it, and they just don't care so long as they get what they think is rightfully theirs, whereas the low-level peons, the servants of the system, they're doing what they understand, and they can't figure out why it doesn't work. So certainly, elements of accident, greed, and stupidity play into it.
Mm-hmm.
But, it's a little of both. Some people know exactly what's going on, and they don't care. It's something that if you follow Kevin Barrett's work, he wrote an article a while back. It was called The Twilight of the Psychopath. And essentially he was talking about a certain class of people who'd rather cheat you out of your last nickel than work with you to make a buck, because that's what gives them their adrenaline rush.
Yeah, I remember reading that article, and he's absolutely right, where they're in it for the game playing. And again, this gets back to that whole Wall Street casino thing. The idea isn't just to make profits, but to make obscenely high profits and to game the system. And they literally, just like gamblers in Las Vegas, they're hooked on that adrenaline rush of getting away with it. And that's really what's driving a huge amount of it, a huge part of it.
Certainly. It's the compulsive behavior. Coming to the subject of Reconstruction, I know we've kind of been joking about, costumes. I just saw something on Glenn Beck, flipping channels about making them wear, party hats while they're celebrating their triumphant victory over the public resistance to, the stimulus and all sorts of ridiculous nonsense.
Yeah.
But if we looking to, I would say, we get so many good ideas from science fiction writers, and one in particular I was thinking in terms of what next. I think part of the problem that we see is a lack of public responsibility. We don't, as a society, tend to associate the welfare of our neighborhood, our towns, our counties, our states, our nation, as our own, our own choices to make. We just kind of pass it off to somebody else. I would think, and I would love to get a comment on this one, if you ever saw the movie or read the book, and I want to say it's Robert Heinlein, Starship Troopers, the system that he was talking about, a variant on that, where certain privileges are earned by service, things like, like voting and, being able to actually hold public office, having to actually have put on the uniform and served, and actually made it a personal responsibility rather than, go through and push papers or hide out in the, in the champagne unit of the National Guard like our previous dictator.
Well, the reality is no matter what system you have set up, those with political connections are always going to circumvent the system, and that's really kind of the problem. I am not sure that Heinlein was actually suggesting that as a model, because if you read a lot of his other books, he's very much of a mind of, government should stay the heck out of people's lives. And I think in Starship Troopers, he was pushing this idea basically to show how abusive it could become. And if you go back to one of his other books, some of his earlier writings about, I'm trying to remember the name of it. I think it was the story called If This Goes On, where he basically talks about out-of-control government and being able to break away from it. So I think the model that he was showing in Starship Troopers, which is, by the way, very similar to what they have in like Israel, I think his goal there was to point out that those who, by service, became eligible to vote would inevitably perpetuate that same system. That it was a system designed to basically engineer out dissent right from the start, and therein lie the danger. Because, you know, and you need to have people in a society who don't agree with everything that's being done if the society is going to grow and evolve. Now, I'm not saying that everybody who's dissenting is automatically correct, okay? But in order to have a discussion about where the society is headed, you've got to be able to have some ideas going in divergent directions. And I think Heinlein's idea that you couldn't actually vote or participate in the society until you had proven that you were part of it was a way of almost halting that societal evolution. Your society is always going to stay that same way forever.
Well, it's certainly understandable. I'm just looking more just as a, you know, as a possible example. I mean, certainly in anything you find, there's, you know, something worth salvaging, worth looking further into.
Yeah, I agree.
What was I going to say? I think the other, you know, one of the other things that I would suggest is, you know, kind of like we've been joking about the, you know, making them wear their clown costumes or, you know, wear their orange jumpsuits.
Yes.
Or NASCAR driver, you know, uniforms. But, certainly, you know, having to have actually served and actually have, you know, put on, I mean, we saw the, you know, resistance to the expansion of the military and the armaments industry from, you know, from General Eisenhower.
Yes.
And of course, we look back to when the Constitution was written. The generals, they understood, you know, the kings and generals and presidents, they actually went and fought the wars. They didn't just sit hundreds of miles away and play a video game of it, or, you know, make a phone call and you know, watch a satellite image of thousands of people being, you know, being killed.
Yeah.
Picked up a sword, they picked up a rifle, and they went into it themselves. And so they had an increased, a sense of caution, we'll call it, towards actually just picking a fight just for the fun of it,
mm-hmm.
where there's a great disconnect now where, you know, we have people go into the service with, you know, with their degrees and automatically skip the actual combat part of it. They put on the uniform and they push papers and they issue orders. Certainly I would want to see the elimination of the, of that, you know, that little loophole
What we need to do is we need to recognize that the military is really not about fighting wars. It is about extracting money from the American people for the privilege of an elite. And now that the military is becoming unpopular again, you know, it's a constant con game. They're going to come up with something that they can scare you with or get you concerned about so that you will give them more of your money. And it's the war on drugs or the war on poverty or the war on terror. Or the Russians, they're trying to get the Russians back to be the enemies that they were in the Cold War. And if that doesn't work, they're going to try global warming. And really, because of the technological advances of our society, we've reached a situation where most people really do have a very comfortable life. They may not have all the toys that they want. They may not have all the latest fashion statements that they're told that they must have. But they've got food, they've got shelter, they've got, you know, basic necessities of life. And it's very hard to get people in that situation to want to work harder to give to the government unless you come up with some kind of a con. And, you know, I mean, I go back and look at the history of the United States right at the close of World War II. I mean, we'd beaten the Japanese and we'd beaten the Germans, but the people who made so much money off of war, they didn't want to let go. So, ooh, let's make the Russians the bad guys now. And anybody who sympathizes with them, we'll call them commies and wreck their careers. We got to go here. Thank you for the call. We'll be back after these words from our sponsors.
Can we talk?
Can we talk?
Can we talk about gun control?
Gun control?
Seems like it should work, doesn't it?
It should work.
You'd think so. Yeah.
Pass the right laws.
Pass the right laws.
And you can disarm the criminals.
You disarm them.
That's the idea.
But the problem is...
The problem?
Criminals don't obey the law.
They don't obey the law.
That's true.
After all, they're criminals.
They're criminals.
Criminals. They'll always find a way to get guns.
No matter how many laws you pass.
Which means
they still have guns.
They still have guns. While the rest of us...
The rest of us?
The rest of us are just left defenseless.
Americans who own guns
People like you and me prevent over 1 million violent crimes every year. Get the facts on gun control. Visit armedandsecure.org.
You are listening to GCN. Visit GCNlive.com today.
Aloha, America. Welcome back to the show here. And I want to close today's show with a thought and what will hopefully be a word of encouragement for those of you out there who, like me, do what we do because we want to live in a world of peace. We don't want nuclear bombs falling on anybody anywhere. We don't want any bombs falling. We want a world where everybody lives together, works together, does commerce together, grows their food together, and we don't have these nutcases running around the halls of power thinking that this or that invisible man who lives in the clouds wants them to go out and lay waste to somebody else's home. And maybe that was a valid social model 2,000-3,000 years ago, but it really is out of place in a world with nuclear technology. One of the most discouraging aspects of fighting against war is that you can never point to a particular point in time and say, I've succeeded. You only have those times when it's obvious that you failed. But we've had one exception to that in that Daniel Ellsberg, who leaked the Pentagon Papers regarding the Vietnam War, and created a national scandal back during the Nixon administration, has had more of the Nixon audio recordings from the White House, the Oval Office, more of the tapes from the White House recording system, the same ones that provided the evidence for his almost impeachment and forced his resignation. Some of those tapes are still classified to this very day, but some of the ones that have recently been released to scholars have shown that Nixon wanted to use nuclear weapons in Vietnam. He wanted to escalate and escalate and escalate the bombing, and his attitude was basically, we're going to bomb them until they see the way the world the way we want them to see. Which seems an echo of so many tyrants and dictators. But the point of the fact is that Nixon, while he wanted to use nuclear weapons on Vietnam, he didn't, because of the growing pressure of the anti-war movement. And I bring this up because those of us who were activists back in the 1960s and back during Vietnam, and yes, I'm one of them, we didn't know we had scored this victory when it happened. We had to wait all these years later to find out. So if you are out there trying to convince the rest of the world that Iran isn't really building nuclear weapons underneath their power station, and we have no more legitimate reason to invade Iran than we had to invade Iraq or Afghanistan, and it seems like nothing is being accomplished that you can actually point to and say, here, we've had a victory. The victories may be hidden from you. And certainly the case is that when we talk about the possibility of another false flag attack, like 9/11, to try and kick off a war. And we have many times over the last several years said there's a potential for this happening. And then when it doesn't happen, you know, people will laugh and say, ah, you thought there was going to be a false flag attack and it didn't happen. We may find out years from now that it was being planned and was called off at the last second. But even if we never find that out, because there is obviously so much about what is going on in the halls of government that we will never learn, because records are continually being destroyed these days, we just need to make that conscious choice that we're willing to run the risk of maybe looking like a little silly or a little bit alarmist to get those warnings out there, because those warnings create doubt. in the minds of people who plan these false flag attacks. And keeping that doubt out there, convincing them that maybe they won't be believed, is our best defense against another false flag attack. Now, I would like to say that we're past that threat because the world is changing, the way information flows to society is changing, and more people inside the government are recognizing that it's a completely different environment. But we do have a lot of old Cold War fossils still in positions of power, and they're still trying to play the games by the rules that worked back in the 60s and 70s. And who knows what they might consider doing if pushed into a corner. So you just do what you're going to do. You talk to as many people as you can. You spread the word. We're working in an advantage right now because most people recognize, because of the claims made about Saddam's nuclear weapons, we now know the government does lie to us and the media does lie to us. And the burden of proof has shifted onto them. So when the government comes up and says, we must attack Iran because they're a threat, you are justified in standing up and saying, I don't believe you. You've got to prove it. Show me the actual evidence. Don't tell me that somebody somewhere found a laptop with all kinds of damning evidence in it. Show me the actual proof. Go in there with a camera, take pictures. And even then, I'm going to be suspicious. Because we have been lied to so much about so many things, with only one goal, and that is to harvest as much money and obedience and soldiers from us as possible for the least amount of upkeep in return. Because ultimately that is the goal of all government, is to extract the most work product from their population for the least amount of upkeep going back. And as we watch our economy stutter, and we watch Barack Obama try and convince us that continuing to loot the ordinary working class people to give money to the banks that got us into this mess is the way to go, it is very alarming that he seems to be listening to nobody except those financial experts who created this mess. And I think we're heading into a very, very, very dark time in our nation's history. Actually, we're there. We're there already. Forget I said heading into. We're there already. And I think what the earlier caller or the listener was saying, we need to start planning in our local communities and in our states of how we're going to get along without the interference of the federal government. Because we're going to see the federal government come in and say, we're going to make everything all better if you will just... And there'll be a hook in there, whether it'll be more money or the loss of more freedoms or sending our children off to another war. Always, anytime the federal government comes in and says they're going to make things better, when they are the people who made it bad to begin with, there's always going to be a hook. They create the problem, then they sell us a solution. They wreck the economy, then they're going to sell us a fix. So, I basically just wanted to put out there that if you are an activist and you're out there working for peace, it's not an endeavor that people who need immediate reinforcement or positive reinforcement or immediate gratification, you're never going to get it there. You just have to know in your heart of hearts that what you're doing is the right thing to be doing. Now, me, I don't believe in an afterlife. I don't believe in a heaven or a heck. This is the only life I'm going to get. And it's up to me to decide what it's going to be lived for. And stopping this next big mistake is definitely very high up there on the list of things to do while I'm still alive. And you just have to decide that the other things that you were doing that are less important, that you're willing to let them go and you're willing to live without them. And very often that's the things that you thought you wanted to do that get taken away from you by a government that thinks that if they just hurt you enough that you'll stop being an annoyance. Well, that doesn't work for people like me, for curmudgeons like me. It just angers me, makes me ornery and cranky and pushing that much harder. Anyway, we're almost to the end of the show here, and we got people in the chat room, and I'm ignoring them to... basically talk here. But real quick, we're actually out of time here. All right, when we come back tomorrow, I want to talk about the anthrax letters case and the framing of Bruce Ivins and Stephen Hatfield, because there's some new developments along there. So, and if I sounded a little tired today, I'm fighting a flu bug. So if you're out there, take your vitamin C, because there are bugs going around. Or somebody dropped a beaker at the bioweapons lab again today. Until tomorrow, stay safe, be well, hug your loved ones, drive carefully, and aloha, America.